Thank you. Thank you, Sean. That's wonderful. I've never been described that way, but I'm, of course, only just a bit older, thankfully, than the people, the musicians who we're hearing tonight. The members of the Australian Youth Orchestra in tonight's prom, who will be conducted by Sir Mark Elder. They're going to be playing a programme of Mahler, Shostakovich, and they're bringing a musical taste of home, too. They're going to open their programme with the London premiere of Amphitheatre by Australian composer Brett Dean. Now, Sir Mark Elder first worked with the Australian Youth Orchestra, all of whom are 25 or under, a quarter century ago.
25 years ago, when the composer of the first item on the programme was then the principal viola. Isn't that wonderful?
With an ear piercing, I gather?
He had an ear piercing and he had hair. He's now, of course, become well known to many of these young players, and he is, of course, the great voice of contemporary Australian life and music, I think.
Mark Elder. And so Brett Dean, the Australian Youth Orchestra's ex-principal viola, is now composing music that his old orchestra is playing.
Yeah, it's quite wonderful, actually, because some things then come full circle in life. And so, you know, it was 26 years ago that I remember playing my first prom here in the Albert Hall with the AYO, with the recently and sadly departed Charlie McCarris.
And this piece particularly, Amphitheatre, I mean, if there's any auditorium in the world that looks like, that is an amphitheatre,
it really
it's the Albert Hall.
It's an amphitheatre, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the words of Michael Ende that I've kind of been inspired by refer to the stony roundness, and you look up while the music's playing, that really is what this building is also all about.
The inspiration comes from Michael Ende's book, Momo.
Yeah.
Tell us about what the relationship between the book and the piece.
Well, the book opens with a very moving and delightful description of this place in which Momo, who's a young homeless girl, finds herself living in the ruins of an old amphitheatre. And I was so taken by this idea. It seemed so bizarre. And then that was combined with this visit to Naples, where I saw one of these old structures close up. And so the chords that you hear at the beginning are always the same but in different colours, as if you're sort of wandering around and seeing the stone shape from different angles in different lights or shades of light. And it then sort of becomes a kind of a bizarre march in a way.
Brett Dean, composer of the piece we're about to hear, Amphitheatre. This is the London premiere of Amphitheatre. It was written originally 10 years ago and commissioned by Symphony Australia for conductor Daniel Harding's first Australian tour. And one of the things that happens in the middle of the piece, there's a huge climax, a really violent music. Brett Dean's imagination of those violent happenings at the ancient Roman and Italian Colosseums. Thankfully, the Royal Albert Hall has only ever been staged rather more genteel gatherings, rather more genteel happenings, like, of course, the BBC proms. Hush in the amphitheatre of the Royal Albert Hall. And here comes Sir Mark Elder on stage to conduct the Australian Youth Orchestra in the London premiere of Australian composer Brett Dean's Amphitheatre.
Thank you.
Brett Dean's Amphitheatre, the London premiere. The London premiere of Brett Dean's Amphitheatre. Sir Mark Elder conducting the Australian Youth Orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall. Mark Elder signalling for Brett Dean to come on stage to accept the applause here. And from the orchestra too. He's making something of a British summer, Brett Dean. He's had a week of concerts as the feature composer of this year's Cheltenham Festival earlier this month. This concert, of course, here. And in September, in the audiences at the Edinburgh International Festival have the chance to see the UK premiere of his opera on Peter Carey's novel, Bliss. And you'll be able to hear a broadcast of Brett Dean's Bliss here on BBC Radio 3. Now, I mentioned that Brett Dean was a viola player with the Australian Youth Orchestra, but his career as a performer took him to the Berlin Phil, where he played with the Berlin Philharmonic from 1984 to 1999. And one of the first pieces he wrote when he decided to become a composer was a piece for the 12 violas of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. Well, music on a different but no less dramatic scale now in tonight's prom with the Australian Youth Orchestra. A selection of six songs from Mahler's Des Knaben Wunderhorn, that miraculous collection of Lieder songs he composed in his 30s, which were the seeds of so much of his later music. They're going to be sung by the brilliant Russian mezzo-soprano Yekaterina Gubanova, who made her debut at the proms at the age of just 24 back in 2003. And it's good to be back.
I think it's the most special gig that a musician can actually do. And also having these people standing in front of you, it's quite humbling. It's like makes you work even more, thinking, my God, they've been standing here and they are still standing. So I should work and make it worth for them.
The songs from Des Knaben Wunderhorn then, the stories they tell in a way are quite, I mean, they range across everything from fantasy to fairy tales to real meditations, but often it's a real kind of intimate atmosphere that you have to create as a singer in this huge space.
Yes, well, I believe that any intimacy is creatable by just opening your heart to the audience, just being as open as you can, because this is something that attracts people to open up to you as well. And this is when both sides are open, this isn't intimacy.
Are you a different character in all of these songs? I mean, you're so experienced on the opera stage now as well.
Yes,
this
is the fun and difficulty of these songs, that you actually get to portray so many characters. You do kids, you do a girl, a boy, a woman, death. It's fantastic. Lots of possibilities and difficulties, of course.
What about this orchestra? Is it different working with a youth orchestra for you than as a
It is different. Yes, it is different. It's different energy, because they never just sit on the chair with, you know, just relax with their back crooked or something. They're always excited. They're always making their best. And the whole aura is very different. It's great. I really like it.
Yekaterina Gubanova. Now, the sequence of six songs that she sings for us starts with the fantastical figures of Rhein Legendchen, after which comes Wer hat dies Liedlein erdacht? Who was it who thought up this song? Then there's the lovelorn sentinel story of Wo die schönen Trompeten blasen, the wasted flirtation of Verlorene Mühe, and then the morbid parable of Das irdische Leben, with its vision of child's death from starvation. And finally, Mahler's Urlicht, Primal Light. That final song you'll recognise as the short fourth movement that Mahler reused in his Second Symphony, where it's the upbeat to that vision of the Last Judgment in the finale of the Second Symphony. So here comes mezzo-soprano Yekaterina Gubanova and conductor Mark Elder to perform songs from Mahler's Des Knaben Wunderhorn with the Australian Youth Orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Thank you. don't eat.
Thank you.
Urlicht, Primal Light, the final song of that selection from Mahler's Des Knaben Wunderhorn. The soloist is Yekaterina Gubanova, and Sir Mark Elgar conducted the Australian Youth Orchestra. That final song, the upbeat to that gigantic finale of the Second Symphony, but an upbeat also, hearing all of those, all six of those songs together there for next week's Mahler at the Proms, the third, fourth and fifth symphonies over two nights on Wednesday and Thursday. Huge applause there for the mezzo-soprano, Yekaterina Gubanova. She's only 31, but she's already got one of those stellar international careers. Based in Paris, she's shortly going to be singing Wagner, Das Rheingold, with Daniel Barenboim at the Staatsoper in Berlin. In demand, really, all over the world at the moment. Mark Elder and Yekaterina Gubanova back on stage. And Mark Elder bringing the whole of the orchestra, the Australian Youth Orchestra, to their feet. A special mention, even if Mark hasn't given it to her, I'm going to give it to her, the leader of tonight's orchestra, 23-year-old Bridget Coleridge, who you heard play that beautifully judged solo throughout, well, in all six songs, but especially in Urlicht. And yet another reminder this season of the special silence that this huge amphitheatre of the Royal Albert Hall is capable of when thousands of people are focused in on the tiniest of sounds. Well, it's interval time in tonight's Prom. Now, the writer Leslie Chamberlain remembers the cruel origins of the Soviet Union's devotion to childhood, the children of the revolution.
60 years after the Bolsheviks took power in Russia, the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party authorized 35 official slogans to remind people of what the revolution of October 1917 was about. They were printed on the front page of Pravda, the Communist Party newspaper, where we Western journalists used to cast a wistful, mocking, curious eye over them. It depended what else was happening in that difficult country which, by 1977, was plunged into open dissent and torturing dissidents and sending them to prison. The Western suspicion was already then, a good 15 years and more before the Soviet Union collapsed, that few Russians remained believers. Actually, I think that estimate of the Russian situation was wrong, or rather, it was not sufficiently nuanced. For those who even half believed and accepted that in practice more went wrong with communism than right, the country was at least trying to live by revolutionary ideals, which any civilized country would want to live by. One such was number 23 on the Central Committee's 1977 list, and it went like this. Long live Soviet women, fervent patriots, active participants in the life of labour and society. Honour and praise to mothers, warmly giving their hearts to the education of their children, the future builders of communism. I came back to this slogan the other day, and my memories of the Soviet cult of the child, when I was trying to make sense of one of the greatest tragedies to beset Soviet Russia in its early years. After the revolution, vast numbers of homeless, orphaned children were roaming the country in gangs with no one to look after them. The bezprizornye, as they were called, were hungry, ill-dressed, often violent, and sometimes armed. Victims of the chain of disasters that hit Russia in the first two decades of the 20th century, they were either orphaned or abandoned by parents who couldn't cope, and they had to scrounge and thieve to survive. There were homeless children in Tsarist times. After the First World War, their number topped 300,000. But then 2 years of civil war and the famine of 1921 ripped into the Russian social fabric with unprecedented ferocity. Feral youngsters, high on drugs, terrorised the towns. Especially they thronged around railway stations, begging and worse. Numbers are difficult to ascertain because the famine in the Volga region hit so hard the authorities could hardly keep track. Lenin's own wife, Nadezhda Krupskaya, wrote in the Communist Party newspaper Pravda in February 1923 that a total of 7 million deserted children has been put on the state's register. By the end of 1923, the figure was 8 million. The first Soviet Commissar for Education and Culture, Anatoly Lunacharsky, who already in 1921 had pleaded in Pravda, "Don't let us forget the children," estimated there were a staggering 9 million abandoned children by 1929. The fate of these abandoned children was a humanitarian disaster, but also, quietly, an ideological disaster, for a country that kept telling itself that the future would be better than the muddled and suffering present, and that would happen because the children of today would be the good communists of tomorrow. The Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, just a boy in those years, remembered waifs in drab tatters who scurried hither and thither, thieving and warming themselves at asphalt cauldrons on the streets, without whom one could not picture the urban life of the 20s. From outside Russia, the League of Nations and the American Commission for Famine Relief watched over a crisis they could do little to alleviate in an inaccessible country. 120 million Save the Children Fund meals were served in Saratov, one of the worst-hit Volga towns, in 1921, before Lenin grew suspicious of the ideological side agenda of foreign aid. Western governments and NGOs largely relied on individual travellers for their information. Some spoke of seeing prehistoric creatures lurking around Russia's railway stations. The British journalist Malcolm Muggeridge saw youngsters going about in packs, barely articulate or recognisably human, with pinched animal faces, tangled hair and empty eyes. I saw them clustered under bridges, lurking in railway stations, suddenly emerging like a pack of wild monkeys, then scattering and disappearing. The French novelist André Gide wondered how on earth these poor little things could survive. Observing the efforts of the new Soviet Russian state to cope, H.G. Wells, in his articles for the Daily Mail in September 1920, wrote of hope amidst the vast spectacle of grisly want and wide decay. In December 1921, the humanitarian traveller F.A. Mackenzie stationed himself in a small Volga town, Buzuluk, where the harvest had failed and state commandeering had crippled what remained of a feasible economy. Refugees were pouring all the time into Buzuluk from the villages around. Many of them abandoned their children in the streets during the night, leaving them to the care of the local authorities. The townsfolk did the best they were able. Numerous rescue homes were opened, and an army of women volunteers worked splendidly, attempting all that kind hearts could. But kind hearts are not enough. The rescuers had little more than the rescued. When children have been very short of food for weeks, culminating in a time of no food at all, they need the daintiest of fare. There was not even milk in the homes. There were few or no doctors to advise, for the doctors were dead or had fled or were ill themselves. Thousands of abandoned children were brought into the homes. Most of them died within a few days. Wells also noticed the kindness of individuals. People who had no ideological sympathy with the Bolsheviks freely gave their services to help the stranded children, alas, with limited effect. The state opened homes called Dietdama, and shelters, which were a kind of halfway house, where the children could spend the night and then be free to leave. The scholar Catriona Kelly, who has made a monumental study of the child in Soviet Russia, was surprised to find a number of unforced positive testimonials to the quality of life in these early institutions. But in the crisis years, many youngsters, after months or longer out on their own, were suspicious of the authorities and chose, or managed, to stay out on the vicious streets without testing the facilities on offer. Pictures from between 1920 and 1923 show ragged, unwashed Dickensian figures hunched over a game of cards. Some Bezprizornie lived in burrows beside the river. A popular resting place was, as Solzhenitsyn noticed, the huge cast-iron cauldrons that road workers used to heat asphalt over the day, which retained their heat. The abandoned children wore clothes, but what clothes? Another Soviet writer, Konstantin Paustovsky, described jackets obtained from some grown-up man or woman. They were long, reaching below the knee, with dangling sleeves. Time, dust and dirt had given them a uniformly mouse-grey colour and made them shine as if covered with oil. They did not have shirts, just their frozen, dirty, greenish-yellow bodies, covered with bleeding, streaking, which they got from scratching. Thieving amongst these children was normal and easy. One gang child drew pictures of how, when people waiting for trains fell asleep, he and his pals emptied their pockets. Many children became prostitutes. I've come back to the problem of the abandoned children of the 20s, precisely because half a century later, no outside visitor to Soviet Russia could have failed to spot the cult of the child, which was part of the country's founding fabric. With ubiquitous playgrounds and the pioneer movement and children's theatres and the huge toy shop Children's World beside the Cheka headquarters in Moscow. The child was sentimentalised as an essential part of Soviet self-belief. The perfect future would one day come when all children would be model communists and happy people in a good and just world. Because the crisis of the homeless children is where that cult began, one can feel through its history just what that experimental country was like, and the accidents and the confusion it was up against, as well as the horrible realities of power. The problem with the homeless children began after 1917, rose to its terrible height after 1921, but then continued with even increased numbers right up to the mid-1930s. Surprisingly, given the pride and secrecy that became characteristic of a Soviet Union that always feared losing face in the West, the old Bolsheviks who founded the country were openly stricken by the tragedy of the orphaned children. Neither Lenin himself nor Krupskaya, who spent much of her time trying to improve education, would have disagreed with the hostile view of an émigré driven out by the 1917 upheaval, that the most pitiful victims of the tragedy that Russia has lived through since the revolution have been the little children. In 1925, Krupskaya famously went on record to say that the problem, as it had grown by that date, was of Soviet creation. Among the big names involved in relief work were, besides Lunacharsky, his institutional rival at the Commission for Social Welfare, the feminist Alexandra Kollontai, the future wartime Soviet president Mikhail Kalinin, and his wife Asya were also active. Asya Kalinin made a careful study of the homes, the Dietdama, which were intended for orphans, but also for children whose working parents couldn't look after them. When she published a report on the years of vagabondage in one area of European Russia, still a useful source for historians, She despaired that places meant to raise children in a new spirit were nothing more than hotbeds of infection. Another old Bolshevik wife who worked alongside Krupskaya to save the children was Zina Zinoviev. Her husband, Grigory Zinoviev, was one of the triumvirate of leaders out of whom Stalin emerged triumphant after Lenin died. The ideological times and Zinoviev's power as the party boss of St. Petersburg, then called Petrograd, turned him into one of history's thugs. Yet, like his colleague, the at least equally murderous Felix Dzerzhinsky, head of Lenin's political police, the Cheka, Zinoviev went on record expressing his love of little children and his hope that when the Soviet Union was peaceful, it would be an ideal place for children to live. As for Dzerzhinsky, he told a colleague, "I want to put a part of my personal energy, and more important, the energy of the Cheka, into the struggle with child homelessness. In this matter, we must rush directly to help, as if we saw children drowning." Lunacharsky's children's world, as one might call it, mixed sincere hope with a liberal attitude to discipline. The old Bolsheviks, men and women like the Lunacharskys and the Lenins and the Zinovievs, who had been party members before 1917, did not believe in juvenile crime, which they saw as the fault of society. They also believed social problems could be solved scientifically by the state, and in that spirit, many early Soviet congresses and conferences were held on the protection of children. But they mixed this broadly left idealism, which could be found nascent in most Western countries of the day, with an ideological passion which, together with terrible state organisation of mass institutions like the Dietdama, is surely what most went wrong in Soviet Russia. In the conservative West, unsullied Bolshevism was as frightening at the beginning as anything that would come later, and particularly with regard to children. When Lunacharsky's commissariat in 1919 insisted that children's communes must serve as the instrument for the destruction of the institution of the bourgeois family, organising life on communist bases, they not only prepare future communist citizens, but guarantee the reconstruction of adult society on new foundations. The New York Times hit back with a furious article entitled, "Reds Are Ruining Children of Russia." Lunacharsky's system of calculated moral depravity, described by Swiss teacher, aims to destroy the home. And that was just the headline. The article began, "The most diabolical of all measures conceived by the Bolshevist rulers of Russia to perpetuate their domination is their systematic corruption of coming generations to undermine and destroy family life." The sad fact was that children orphaned or handed over to the state by their parents often did suffer from lack of family life and did make good communists in the worst possible way because of their early experience of cruelty and criminality, both on the streets and inevitably in the homes themselves. It's interesting to reflect that liberal approaches to discipline in the state's new children's homes proved just as unworkable as the old Bolsheviks' liberal attitudes to marriage. The famous Bolshevik free love experiment failed because easy divorce encouraged men to leave their wives and created new problems with uncared-for children. When liberal attitudes led, or at least seemed to lead, to social chaos, the Stalinist state kicked in. Husbands couldn't be disciplined, but delinquent children could, and also made use of, by a fearful regime. Under Dzerzhinsky, the Cheka and its successors vied with the education authorities for control of the children's homes, not quite from the beginning. And as soon as they established themselves, they were well placed to use the Bezprizornia as a recruiting ground. A whole generation of homeless children, subjected to an ever less liberal and ever more militarized regime, matured into the men and women who made Stalin's killing machine work. As coercive ideology took over from liberal idealism, endemic Soviet disorganization sealed the fate of the orphans. From the outset, the children's homes couldn't cope with the volume of youngsters, let alone with requirements to offer drama, music, handicrafts, and so on. Private charity was dismissed as a factor of the capitalist past. But then the state was so needy, it ran a poster campaign demanding citizens wake up to their social duty to care for the homeless children. Meanwhile, the command economy failed to provide. And when it did, so much pilfering and waste affected supplies that the effort was lost. Train crew stole the shoes and clothes they were supposed to be delivering to the orphanages. After 1925, with Stalin emerging as Lenin's successor, and increasingly over the next 10 years, libertarian ideals on the upbringing of children gave way to the drill hall vision of the education theorist Anton Makarenko, a kind of Soviet Baden-Powell. For the coherence of Soviet society to come, this was actually no bad thing. Many children loved their Soviet scouting days. The downside was conformity. A far worse side of the new spirit showed itself when, from around 1928, with forced collectivization and the purging of the small farmers, the kulaks, and the famine of 1933, the number of homeless children began to rise again dramatically. Just as Lunacharsky ventured that optimum high figure of 9 million, the new Stalinist ideology began to attack the bezprizornia as parasites and wreckers. As some were brutally absorbed into the Stalinist apparatus, others, no doubt, ended up in the labour camps, which took millions of lives in the 1930s and 40s. The story of the bezprizornia is interesting for the light it sheds on the whole Soviet enterprise. The idea that the state would provide a gentle, egalitarian, humanitarian model upbringing for children while their parents worked, or if they were homeless, was at best innocent. The fact that the early children's homes offered, along with kindness and ideological dreaming, such material inefficiency that more than half their intake in the famine crisis died, reminds me of how the labour camps of the Gulag began. Both were seen as a kind of educational establishment, and both were run by the political police. Not homeless children, but ideological opponents of the regime got sent to the Gulag. But in both cases, the official aim was re-education. Both kinds of camps supplied a workforce, with, in the children's labour communes, the Cheka supervising youngsters still in training. It was not because they became places of punishment that the camps of the Gulag were soon deathly, but because from the beginning the state could not cope with its own project. The massive number of people arrested and sent there far outstripped available food and accommodation and medicine. And the problem with the children's homes after 1918 was comparable. As with the whole Soviet experiment, at stake was a blueprint to reorganise the lives of a mass of human beings, whether out of need, benevolence, or ideological dreaming. But the state simply could not see the project through in material terms. At the same time, it overestimated the capacity of boys and girls and men and women to be good and cooperate with each other and obey authority. That was one of the moral beginnings of communism that went wrong. Authority, however benevolently envisaged by those who conceive of it, is always something else in the way it is carried out. It was just asking too much of children to wrench them away from their parents, give them no family, only a substitute institution, and expect them to grow into fine human beings. Even worse, the experiment was carried out on millions of children who found themselves alone and had no choice.
The Children of the Revolution was presented by Leslie Chamberlain and produced in Bristol by Tim Dean. So, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom. Just one work on the programme, Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. I spoke to tonight's conductor, Sir Mark Elder, on playing, approaching this epic symphony with these young players.
This orchestra is full of young, intelligent musicians who can play their instruments. Many of them have been together playing chamber music, chamber orchestras, tutorials, all through their adolescence. This orchestra is the top of an Australian youth and music mountain that builds up to this orchestra. And interestingly, it was hard for them initially to find and understand the emotional temperature of Shostakovich. So I talked to them a lot about his life, what we know about it, the sort of cultural atmosphere, the overwhelming sense of fear and insecurity under which they all lived, right through the 30s, 40s and 50s. and that this symphony is a great statement to his determination never to be bowed down, that he would write what he wants to write. And the four notes at the end of the symphony hammered out on the timpani, representing his name and his defiance. Whatever anyone may have assumed from his very nervous chain-smoking exterior, inside there was a will of iron that he would only write what he wanted to write. We will all die, myself included, but my music will survive, I think is a very powerful message.
Sir Mark Elder, but there's more to the meshing of the personal and the political in this symphony, Shostakovich's 10th, in the slow movement, which comes third after a long and very severe, but one of the most magnificent movements Shostakovich ever wrote, the first moderato, the venomous scherzo and allegro. In the third movement, the allegretto, Shostakovich introduces the cipher of his own name, so D-S-C-H, or if you want to be pedantic, D, E-flat, C, and B. But he entwines this musical moniker, his own musical moniker, with a strange, another allusion to another human being. It's the notes of a horn melody that you hear just after the DSCH motto that comes unmistakably on the woodwind. And towards the end of the movement, the two themes are combined. Now this, it turns out, and nobody knew at the time, is a very direct, personal, almost autobiographical approach to composition that Shostakovich is using, because this represents this other tune, the horn tune, represents the initials of a pupil with whom, an Azerbaijani composition pupil with whom he was infatuated at the time, Elmira Nazirova. And the scherzo that precedes it, that venomous allegro, has been, well, it was said that Shostakovich himself described it as a portrait of Stalin, that's somehow the purest evil that his music got to. But as David Fanning in tonight's program note says, it's really the articulation of a musical idea that it seems can only have this form. Shostakovich's finale is yet another of those finales in which you feel exhilarated, but not quite sure if what you've heard is a victory or simply a resignation in the face of what life had doled out to Shostakovich. But it's a piece that these young players of the Australian Youth Orchestra know well. They've been playing, this is just the latest leg of a tour that's taken them from Australia to China, two concerts in China, and they were playing in Copenhagen, playing this concert in Denmark. They go on to Harrogate, and they end this globe-trotting world tour with Sir Mark Elder at the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, a hall that Mark Elder knows very well indeed. A word for those of you who are listening in stereo, as I'm sure almost all of you are. You'll notice that the violins, Mark Elder's got the violins either side of him. The first's on the left, the second's on his right. But he's also split the double basses so that they're behind both the first violins and the second violins. So here comes Mark Elder to conduct the Australian Youth Orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall in Shostakovich's 10th symphony.
Thank you.
A hollow musical victory, or a symbol of the individual defeating the Soviet machine? Well, in the thrill of performance, maybe it just doesn't matter. The end of Shostakovich's 10th Symphony, the Australian Youth Orchestra, conducted here at the Royal Albert Hall by Sir Mark Elder. Warm reception from the Promos tonight. Foot-stomping reception for these young players from Australia. All of them under 25, on tour around the world at the moment. Mark Elder returns to the platform. Australia is a place that's close to Mark Elder's heart. He told me that he conducted his first full concert in Melbourne, and he had a close association with the Sydney Opera House and Ted Downes, who was there, Sir Edward Downes, who was there. Mark Elder bringing the woodwind soloists of the Australian Youth Orchestra to their feet. Unlike our National Youth Orchestra, these players are a bit older. Mark Elder told me that they all plan to be professional musicians in Australia. Only a handful, he said, want to be lawyers or doctors. Special round of applause there for Brent Miller, the Australian Youth Orchestra's timpani, so well used in that finale, and the percussion section. And Mark Elder brings the leader of the Australian Youth Orchestra, Bridget Coleridge, to her feet, and the rest of the orchestra. Another link with Australian Youth back at the top of the programme, composer Brett Dean. Brett Dean is a really important symbol for music education in Australia. He's closely associated with the Australian National Academy of Music in Melbourne. And he's a model, really, for all of these young players to follow, not just the viola section. The two concerts the orchestra have just played in China were, Mark Elder was saying, totally different experiences. They played what he says is the best hall he's ever played in his life, the new concert hall in Beijing. But some 2.5 hours of apparently death-defying journeys at death-defying speeds. They found a concert hall with a really inexperienced audience, so that when he left after the first ovation at the end of the performance of the Shostakovich Symphony, the audience went up, went and left as well. So there was just 30 seconds of applause. No danger of that tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall. Rapturous reception for these well-travelled young musicians. Mark Elder gets back on the podium. We're going to have an encore. Australian music at the start and Australian music, kind of, at the end of the Australian Youth Orchestra's prom with Sir Mark Elder. Percy Grainger's Irish Tune in County Derry, a.k.a. the Londonderry Air of Danny Boyle. Music for fiddles, medium fiddles and big fiddles, bringing this concert at the Royal Albert Hall to an end. Tomorrow actually all day at the Royal College of Music, there's a Proms Plus event where you can, a family concert celebrating the music of Stephen Sondheim, which will be featured in the evening prom at 7:30 tomorrow night. Now though, with this corner of South Kensington forever transformed into a little outpost of the Antipodes, time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Jonathan Swain.
Thank you very much, Tom. Tom Service there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, as well as the BBC iPlayer for listening again, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom broadcast again on Wednesday afternoon, this coming Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, now on BBC Radio 3 with the time at 9:45, another chance to hear Ideas, the British version, the series in which historian and now Labour MP Tristram Hunt traces the path of ideas that have emerged in this country and then spread beyond our shores. In this programme, first broadcast last October, Tristram traces the paths of influence of the Garden City.
In front of me is a diagram entitled The Three Magnets. It hangs on the wall of the Town and Country Planning Association in central London, and it sets out how a fusion of the best aspects of town and country can come together in what is called town country, where you would have nature but also social opportunity. You would have space but also high wages. It's dated 1898, a relic of an era which set many utopian ideas coursing through British veins, and this one of the most extraordinary, the Garden City.
Town and country must be married, and out of this joyous union will spring a new hope, a new life, a new civilization.
But sketching out a utopian thesis like this was one thing, driving it through quite another. So when a man with the richly Victorian name of Ebenezer Howard drew this plan in front of me and published it in a book, Garden Cities of Tomorrow, you could have been forgiven for patting him on the head, smiling and forgetting all about it.
Mr. Howard is not content with half measures. Like Sir Thomas More, he builds a utopia. The only difficulty is to create it. But that is a small matter to utopians. The Times, 19th of October, 1898.
For all the scepticism of newspapers like The Times, he did build his city, here in Letchworth, in Hertfordshire. Begun by Howard and his colleagues in 1903, Letchworth Garden City was the first town-country magnet. This was an idea that attempted to fuse the utopian with the practical. It was also a brilliantly flexible, adaptable idea, which is one reason why it spread across the world. And it all began here.
I will undertake, then, to show how, in town country, equal, nay, better opportunities of social intercourse may be enjoyed than are enjoyed in any crowded city, while yet the beauties of nature may encompass and enfold each dweller therein.
I'm walking away from Letchworth Station, leaving the trains from London behind me. Alongside me is Professor Stephen Ward of Oxford Brookes University. Stephen, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about Ebenezer Howard. Who was the visionary behind this Garden City?
Well, he was a remarkably modest man. He was born in London in 1850, started work as a clerk, a fairly restless figure initially. But then in the 1880s, he became a lot more interested in social reform.
Well, Stephen, we're walking along a super suburban road with our detached cottages, trees lining both sides of it, a very green, spacious feel. How important for Ebenezer Howard was this mix of environmental reform and social improvement?
Howard certainly believed that if you reformed land, then peacefully you could reform the whole of society. So if you could cut out the speculators, if you could cut out the absentee landlords, if you could replace them with some kind of unified collective ownership, then that was the key. And you could generate a lot of things for people to have. You could generate good social facilities, you gave people lots of space, and it wouldn't cost the earth. Then he believed gradually that sort of spirit would spread through society.
How did they find the funds to build Letchworth originally?
Well, with great difficulty.
But what does seem extraordinary is that the Daily Mail newspaper was behind some of these attempts to create a cottage architecture. Why was the Daily Mail involved with Letchworth Garden City?
Well, the proprietor of the Daily Mail, Lord Northcliffe, he was gearing his newspaper towards the lower middle classes, the people who were aspiring in very large numbers to live in the suburbs of London. And the kind of environments they were looking for were cottage-style housing with gardens. So I think he recognised that this was something that appealed to his readers.
So what were the other intellectual influences which Howard was drawing upon?
The Russian anarchist Peter Kropotkin, his writings were also coming to be known. That, I think, is also an important strand. So
we have this lovely situation of the Daily Mail trying to build its newspaper as the organ of the lower middle classes, actually funding cottages and housing developments in a settlement partly inspired by anarchism. Now, Ebenezer Howard was not a planner, was not a qualified architect. The man brought in to put flesh on the bones of these Hertfordshire hills was Raymond Unwin. Tell us about Unwin.
Well, Unwin was an architect very, very much in the William Morris mould. And he was a pioneer in terms of improving housing design in the during the early 20th century. This idea of the cottage ideal of housing for working people.
We have become so used to living among surroundings in which beauty has little or no place that we do not realise what a remarkable and unique feature the ugliness of modern life is. In old towns and streets, we read, as in an open book, the story of a life governed by impulses very different from our own. Raymond Unwin, Town Planning in Practice.
Now, Stephen, you suggested that the laying out of Letchworth inevitably involved compromises from Ebenezer Howard's, you know, first 1898 vision. Yet somehow it caught the imagination of all sorts of planners, architects, utopians, visionaries. Who began to make their way on this pilgrimage to the first garden city?
Very quickly they began to spread the word in other countries, really across the world. I mean, there was a great interest, and people came in fact to see Howard as he became better known. You know, there's accounts in Japan of people from the Japanese Imperial Home Office coming specifically to meet Ebenezer Howard to pick up what they could and taking the idea back to Japan.
And do you think there's anything in the actual idea of the Garden City which makes it so portable?
One of the major problems of building a town like Letchworth is that you were starting from nothing. In London, the underground system was being extended out into countryside. So it was much easier to take that kind of residential package that Raymond Unwin had perfected to make healthy, attractive surroundings that got the best of light and air and sunshine, and then apply it on the edge of cities.
And that's where Unwin went next, leaving behind him exhausting battles over finance, design and ethos involved in trying to realise a full-blown garden city. He did as I'm doing and took the train from Letchworth down to London. He'd been commissioned to create new areas of decent housing for working people, not in a brave new town like Letchworth on virgin Hertfordshire fields, but in the city where they had all fled from. He left some of Howard's more radical ideas for transforming society behind him, but he brought with him to the capital the idea of reforming the physical space of the city, of using planning to create decent places for workers to live in what he called garden suburbs. And something of Howard's scheme for cooperation survived too. This is the Haven Arms in West London, a busy residential pub. Pictures of old Ealing with trams trundling down the high street on the walls. But it was from discussions in this pub that the first of Raymond Unwin's garden suburbs emerged, developing Ebenezer Howard's ideas for use in the outer reaches of cities like London. In 1891, Howard had set up a cooperative building company. It had a branch here in Ealing, and in 1897, six of its members decided to build houses just north of here. They eventually created a tenants' association, raised money from wealthy supporters of the movement to improve local workers' housing. And in 1901, they began building. I'm now going to meet Professor Peter Hall, a resident who lives nearby, but also one of Britain's leading urban historians. He's going to tell me more about the ideas of this unsung area of West London. Peter, we're in front of a row of terraced houses where Brentham began.
This was the beginning of the co-partnership tenants movement, a very important movement before World War I. And there were, between 1901 1914, I guess 20 or 30 of these garden suburbs developed in this way. Importantly, it was the working men who were to build their own houses cooperatively. It's rather dull housing, obviously. They took pattern books. But nonetheless, compared with the housing they'd come out of in the London of 1901, it must have been terrific.
And if we swing on our heels and look towards Ludlow Road, we see a very different aesthetic suddenly before our eyes, a cottage aesthetic almost.
It was a direct result of bringing in Raymond Unwin and Barry Parker, who were the great garden suburb architects. It seems that almost every house is different.
What strikes me though, and as you suggested, the architects had originally and earlier worked at Letchworth, but this is consciously a garden suburb rather than a garden city. What marked out the difference?
Oh, it was an important difference. In fact, it split the garden city movement. Unwin in particular seems to have developed the notion that it was okay to build garden suburbs. Other people in the movement never really accepted garden suburbs as pucker developments. And the garden cities were supposed to make a profit which would then be ploughed back into social services. So they were to become local welfare states. This was never properly attainable here in Brentham.
There's been criticism over the years of garden suburbs and the consequences of garden suburbs. But standing here with the Brent River Park footpath, with these beautiful gardens, with these individually nuanced designed houses, I mean, it's absolutely a delightful place to live, isn't it?
It's delightful. It's an Arcadian vision. So if you created hundreds of places like this, people would love it.
I've now left Brentham to come to North London, to Hampstead Garden suburb, Brentham's younger but better known little brother. Raymond Unwin was hired to design this place by the great Victorian philanthropist Henrietta Barnett. And looking at a white, clapperboard, red-doored old farmhouse from where he designed a template which would go right around the world. But first of all, the world came here to see how it was done. I'm now going to go inside and meet Mark Swennerton, author of Building the New Jerusalem and an expert on the garden city and garden suburb idea. Mark, we're now sitting in an oak-beamed low-windowed sitting room where Unwin himself would have stayed during his time in this cottage. How did Raymond Unwin find himself here?
Well, Unwin moved here after he'd been given the commission to design the layout for Hampstead Garden Suburb. And it was here then that people who wanted to come and see him, this is where they came. So it became a kind of place of pilgrimage. Hampstead Garden Suburb very quickly became the most famous piece of innovative urban design anywhere in the world. And it really was somewhere that people flocked to see. There was a big town planning conference in London in 1910. A lot of people came from abroad to see that. And that was really when Hampstead Garden Suburb was being developed. If you were in the chosen few, you came to see Unwin as well.
Who amongst that chosen few would be coming to see him in this living room or visiting him in his study?
One of the most important people who came to see Unwin was Frenchman Henri Sellier, a social democrat politician from the west of Paris. And he came here because he was planning to build a series of cités jardins, of garden suburbs, around the centre of Paris. And he brought a group of Parisian architects so that they could see what had actually been built here. They'd read about it, they'd seen it in the books, and now they wanted to come and see it for themselves. And so they came and they saw Hampstead Garden Suburb, and they conversed with Unwin, and they took those ideas back with them to Paris.
What ideas specifically did he take from Unwin, and did he then manipulate them, reinterpret them for a specifically French context?
He translated huge sections of Unwin's major work, Town Planning in Practice, and was completely explicit in the fact that Unwin was the person that should be followed. And we can have a look at one of the early parts of Hampstead Garden Suburb, which Sellier said this was the ideal as far as housing was concerned.
Mark, we're now deep in Hampstead Garden Suburb, looking up a cul-de-sac. What are we looking at here?
Well, this was perhaps the archetypal Parker and Unwin cul-de-sac. This was developed in the very early stage at Hampstead Garden Suburb, and it really exemplifies everything that Unwin was offering in terms of a new approach to urban design. And in particular, there was a photograph of it published in Unwin's book Town Planning and Practice in 1909, which became hugely influential, just this single photograph. And we know that Henri Sellier had the photograph rendered into a drawing and included it in his publication on housing design 10 years after the original photograph had appeared.
Now, you've got a sketch of that Sellier image, which is here before us, which shows the gently curving road of Asman's Place, where we're standing, with some surprisingly full trees.
There's this pair of oak trees, which was here before the development took place, and you can see that the road curves around those oak trees in order to retain them, because Unwin believed that a close bond with nature was fundamental to human well-being.
Now, these aren't detached houses. There's a clustering of developments. Again, was that an aesthetic decision? What was the rationale behind that?
Well, what Unwin wanted to do was to get away from the terraced housing of conventional late 19th century cities. And he found this technique of doing it, where you could build a block of four or six houses joined together and then give access to the rear by means of what he called a tunnel built through the houses.
Here we seem to have one of the access passageways through the cluster of houses you suggested, and it provides an extraordinary vista.
This is a real tour de force, because this is using stacked tiles laid into the surface of the wall to emphasise this semicircular arch,
which almost seems like a rising sun.
And then you can see behind the big semicircular arch, we have another one behind, which emphasises this perspective. So it actually looks as though we're looking down some huge long distance, when in fact we're looking down something only 20 feet deep.
It's extraordinary care taken for what was meant to be social housing, in a sense.
Yep, there's absolutely a social philosophy to this, because it's the idea that beauty should not be the preserve simply of the wealthy.
And was that something Sellier took from his visit here to Hampstead Garden Suburb?
That is something that Sellier took directly, because he believed that at Hampstead Garden Suburb he had found the formula which could provide for a working population, a form of housing that was the ideal.
I followed Henri Cellier and his architects back to the outer suburbs of Paris to find out what use he made of his visit to Unwin and Hampstead Garden suburb. Here in Suresnes, the city jardin Cellier created after his trip to North London, his achievement is still remembered. I'm in the Museum of Suresnes, which is currently showing a new exhibition about Cellier's life and work. I've come to meet the curator, Marie-Pierre de Guillaume, and the local Garden City scholar, Ginette Batty-Tornikien.
Cellier works on the extension, plan of Paris, and he has the idea to build nearly 20 big or small garden cities all around Paris, to have no more this problem of 10 people living in, just in one room and without water, gas and everything, you know. So he planned to build all these garden cities and, of course, because he was mayor of Suresnes, he built his garden city in Suresnes.
I think that he met very quickly Raymond Unwin, and he was very, very affected by the English ideas. And of the most important, it's to build and to change the common life of people.
We're seeing now in front of us the plan of Suresnes as the garden city.
Yes, and we can see there all the recommendation of Unwin about how to build a new city.
We've now moved from the museum to the heart of old Suresnes. Marie-Pierre, what are we looking at here?
So we are looking at the first block of houses and flats who was built from 1920 to 1925. So you have a resume, a synthesis of the different housing built in the Garden City, a block of flats with four floors and cottage. And these cottages are very similar of the cottage of Hampstead Garden Suburb.
That's what's immediately striking, is the similarity between some of Unwin's designs for Hampstead Garden Suburb, but jutted right up against quite substantial blocks of apartments, which has a very different feel to Hampstead Garden Suburb. Ginette, was this the innovation in France, what made Cellier's garden city different to the English model?
In this moment, we can see this. The French decide in the first buildings to show the difference, to show that they want to have mixed buildings like mixed population. They show with what they built the people that they want to have in the garden cities.
So just as in Letchworth, you're going to have the importance of a social mix, having workers' cottages on the one hand. In this case, this would be apartment flats and then slightly grander houses for a middle-class mix.
In the cottage, you have bath that you have not in the flats. So you can mix also the population, you know. And you can have the worker, and also after you have can have the chief of the worker.
And that ethical ideal of mixing people together in the garden city, that was important to Cellier.
Yes, very important. And the people say that they meet, Henri Cellier at a corner or at a cafe. And
Cellier lived here?
Yes.
It was an idea to have a sort of a life of neighbours. We are all neighbours and we have to like this.
So we take some of the aesthetic of Unwin and we take some of the communal, almost socialist ideas of Howard, but then have a very different French component to it.
Yes, it's very different, but in fact you have similar thinking for a lot of things. It's the opposite of the anonymous life of the big city.
In Germany too, the garden city idea was developed along similar lines to Suresnes and Letchworth. In 1909, garden city called Hellerau was developed outside Dresden in eastern Germany. But the thing that made Howard's idea so fertile, so adaptable to conditions in many different countries, also left it open to being twisted into a malignant new shape
quite unforeseen by its mild-mannered inventor. In the context of the garden city idea's popularity in Germany, a geographer called Walter Kristaller developed something called central place theory. As Gerhard Fehl of the Aachen University School of Planning Theory and Town Planning explains.
Howard had this idea of solving up the city and replacing it by this structure of independent settlements. It was important that things grew from downward up. This is kind of a grassroots idea of cooperatives, of self-determined settlements. And the German idea was the other way around. There is the central city, and to keep it in future, you have to build suburbs around it. Is the German version, or how they understood the garden city, namely more or less as a kind of a geometrical structure, which reflects a hierarchy, which is very different from what Ebenezer Howard had thought of. This was taken by Kristaller as a new form for regional planning. I think he probably knew Ebenezer Howard's idea, but he never mentioned the name Ebenezer Howard. He wasn't taking up this idea of Ebenezer Howard. If he took something up, it was a kind of second or third stage transformation of Ebenezer Howard, which then he has maybe used for his work when he came to Poland.
Kristaller was summoned to join the Office of Land and Soil under the aegis of Heinrich Himmler and was charged with coming up with a plan for the reorganization of occupied Poland. As the existing population was driven from the land, Kristaller was given total freedom to plan. One of the planners who worked on this was an old garden city advocate called Paul Wolf.
When it came to founding new central places, be it villages or be it market cities, the Nazis needed to have the help of architects and urban designers, and Paul Wolf was one of them. He had already, before the First World War, developed new patterns for city design on the lines of Ebenezer Howard, but more on only on the geometry than on the content. So he had the idea of this kind of upward-down centralization, and he was called into to Poland, like others, he was not the only one, to design a new garden, kind of garden cities in this new system, in this new network which Kristaller had proposed.
I'm back in Britain now at the site of the second and last garden city founded here by Ebenezer Howard. Welling Garden City, which lies on the railway from Letchworth to London. Like Letchworth and Hampstead Garden Suburb, this place played a crucial role in the spread of the Garden City idea right around the world. With me, at the edge of a cul-de-sac on a blustery, blowy day, is the architect, town planner and historian of the Garden City, Mervyn Miller. Was Welling as important as Letchworth in terms of propagating the Garden City idea? Did the missionaries spread out from here and tell the story? Did people come in here and see how it was laid out?
Oh yes, they certainly did. In the 1920s there were a stream of people coming along. It took a few years from the foundation in 1919 to have anything built, but this is what planners from all over the world came to see in those years.
One of those foreign visitors was Alexander Bloch.
He'd been involved with the spread of the garden city theory in Russia before and immediately after the revolution. Indeed, he made his own translation of Garden Cities of Tomorrow, Sadri Goroda, and that, of course, was very influential in reconstruction after the Russian Revolution. But Bloch wasn't part of that. He came to live in Welling Garden City, became a part of the community, and actually died here.
So we've had France, we've had Germany, we've had Russia, but the really big leap is across the Atlantic. When we think of the Garden City in America, we think of Radburn. Tell us about the connections between there and here.
A couple of planners who were extremely interested in the Garden City movement Henry Wright and Clarence Stein started to formulate ideas for new community planning in the United States during the 1920s, and they were early visitors to Welwyn. They came in 1923 or 1922, we're not quite certain which year, but they would have seen the area where we're now in its earliest incarnation. The trees would not have grown up, it would have looked more like a building site, but here were the seeds which they applied to the Radburn concept, which emerged during the later 1920s.
And what would they have taken back with them from the cul-de-sac we're now standing in?
Wright and Stein would probably have visited Ebenezer Howard at his house, which is a few blocks away from here. They would have walked up Valley Road and come to visit this cul-de-sac, and they would have walked through, and you can get through this cul-de-sac into the next one with a pedestrian link. So there is one of the seeds for the separation of pedestrians and vehicles that you get developed at Radburn.
So how do we make an idea of a garden city, which is almost quite an intimate idea with Ebenezer Howard, except the motor car age?
Well, it was a question of evolution. Already in Hampstead Garden Suburb, you started to get acceptance of the motor car in the early years, and here it was more generally accepted that cars would be part of the mix which had to be included. The Americans took it further because they believed, and it's still a controversial notion, that pedestrian movement and vehicular movement should be separated. Wright and Stein were very keen indeed on this. And if I can quote from Stein's book, Toward New Towns from America, Stein writes, "I went abroad in search of more constructive action. In England, new towns and new towns after the war were attempting to chart a new way. The second garden city, Welwyn, was being built. I returned to America a disciple of Ebenezer Howard and Raymond Unwin."